I'm here in the city of Bombay or Mumbai, the large Indian city on the west coast of India, and sitting with the academic, legal scholar and human rights expert Usha Ramanathan. She has been indefatigable in her work when it comes to protecting the rights of the poor, the marginalized and the disenfranchised in India. She's been doing it for years. She has also been actively engaged with the international discourse on business and human rights. Those of us familiar with the work of the International Council for Human Rights Policy, Usha had played a role with it when it was developing its early thinking on corporate responsibility with regard to human rights. Usha lives in Delhi, but we have met in Mumbai. First question to you, Usha, is that you worked for many, many years on the Bhopal incident and the aftermath of that. It's now 30 years. Where are we now? What have we learned from what happened? And in terms of particularly getting a remedy for the victims, where are we today?
I think one of the things, we've done a kind of reassessment at the end of 30 years, and we had a number of people who've worked on the Bhopal gas disaster and who've worked in Bhopal. We've had a range of people reflecting on what's happened over this period, and we had a series that we put out. And what we
These were the articles in the newspaper, The Statesman, which will provide a link to, of course.
Okay. So this, you know, what we found was that, for one, there has been very little development in law that will help victims in the event, that will prevent the creation of victims. That's the first thing. There have been very few developments in law. The second thing is that what law has been brought in? Because, you know, we had the Bhopal gas disaster in 84, and in 85, we had the Shriram gas, oleum gas leak from the Shriram Foods and Fertilizers plant.
And which was near Delhi.
Which is in Delhi.
In Delhi itself, okay.
And so gave, you know, both the Supreme Court and the people around a direct flavor of what could happen if such a disaster were to envelop a city and envelop a population. So one of the remedies that the court then fashioned in the context of the Shriram case was that you should not have hazardous industries located where there are large populations. And in Delhi, by 1996, they had outlawed industries. Of course, they've come back because, you know, there is a natural link between populations and industry. And what we found was that there was a lot of talk that happened about relocation of risk, but not enough about the reduction of risk. That's why, you know, the idea of risk is one thing that we've still not learned how to deal with. And some of these principles, like the NIMBY principle, the not in my backyard principle, they have, you know, it's still that many of these hazards will be located in places where the more vulnerable reside, because those with more power in their hands are able to keep it off their backyards. So this is an issue that we are contending with even after 30 years. So that's one huge problem. The second thing is that we've not been able to bring in any changes in the law in relation to corporate liability, both in civil terms and in terms of criminal law. So we've had a dilution of the understanding of responsibility of the corporation and not an enhancement of our understanding. So it's not been a good road. What this kind of talking about it altogether at the end of 30 years has done is to provide some kind of an agenda for us for what we need to do between, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. Because we can't keep going down this route.
Because you mentioned the fact that industry tends to come up in areas near the cities, and which brings me to the next question I had. The hot topic here is, of course, the new Land Acquisition Act in India, where industry wants land and it is trying to use the principle of eminent domain, on which you've done a lot of work also, and we've both been talking about it in the past. Can you tell me what the new act, which is not an act, it's an ordinance actually, so it's kind of decree, as it were, what it might do and what could be the human rights protection. And it might also help if you very briefly describe what eminent domain means for those of us who are not lawyers.
So I'll just start with eminent domain. Eminent domain is actually a doctrine that says that the state can acquire private land for a public purpose on payment of compensation. Now, each of these elements need to exist. It has to be private land for a public purpose for, you know, on payment of compensation. Now, the what has in fact happened is that the state has started acting like it is sovereign over the whole territory of the country. which is not actually eminent domain. It is a usurpation of powers that do not exist anywhere. And we don't seem to have found the language in it which to challenge that. So we have spoken about it so far in trying to contain the way in which the state exercises this power, but we've not yet managed to make the state recognize that it doesn't have this power. It actually doesn't exist. It's not a it's not there in the constitution. It's not anywhere else. Now, we had an 1894 law which, you know, which under which land acquisition kept happening, and from especially the 80s, from the 1970s and 1980s, we've had pitched battles all around because, you know, many people, many communities that have been displaced. You know, the concept of mass displacement came in the late 70s and early 80s, and has been a public issue ever since. The conflicts in the field where people have been saying, you can't deprive us of our land and you can't take away our land and hand it over to somebody else for whatever purposes it is that they're going to use it, that has resulted in a lot of talk over the years about rehabilitation being a means through which they will give a certain kind of legitimacy to acquisition, which was otherwise very much like appropriation. And mass displacement also meant, unlike land acquisition, which is only connected, you know, which earlier on was only connected with people who lost land because they owned land or they had an interest, a legal interest in land, we find that has, you know, the mass displacement debate changed the understanding of land acquisition. And, you know, because they said it's not only about people who own land or who have interest in land, which is legal interest, but also large numbers of people who are attached to that land in various ways and are dependent, therefore, on the land continuing to be the way it is. So, you know, just as an example, like you would say, potters may not own the land, but they are linked with that land because...
And they have a customary ownership, at least, of some sort. Well, or customary claim on the land.
But that, you know, to an extent, you could say that if you were able to establish an interest that you had in that land, right, you could come within the eminent domain principle. But the problem was that many people didn't have any ownership or in, you know, legal interest in the land, but their life was linked with that land. So large numbers of communities, people who were not landowners but who were attached to it, including agricultural laborers, for instance, if the land went, you know, the value of their labor vanished. So the idea that when you acquired land, you did not just affect the community from whom you were acquiring the land, but a large mass of people, that has become, you know, commonly understood now. And in many places, it has been conflict which has prevented projects from taking off because people are saying, like, you can't just throw us out and, you know, leave us at the mercy of our fates, as it were. We are not moving. And so there have been, you know, large, if you were to just mark the conflict on a map, you'll find that it is all over the country.
Right.
It's to overcome that, because industry was saying, you know, we need land, and with liberalization coming in and asking for foreign direct investment and making corporations a center of growth and of development, all within inverted commas, the local communities, you know, the state then needed to get the local communities to move. So we've seen a few things happen over these years, some of which are really disturbing. One of them is states getting into MOUs with corporations.
These are memorandums of understanding.
Memorandum of understanding. So from a state being a neutral agency which will protect the vulnerable and the weak, it becomes an agency which is in a relationship with a corporation saying, I will help you get land, I will help you get environment clearance, I'll help you get forest clearance, and I will help you with maintaining law and order around your, you know, where you want to, around your project area, so that you can carry on with your project. We started pitching the state against the people, against local populations. It is to get more, you know, it was in a sense to do some kind of a social engineering that after years, after at least 20 years of battling over the nature of the acquisition law, they changed it in 2013. It wasn't the perfect law. And it tried to bring in too many interests. The farmer, the tribal, the corporation, everybody's had to be placed on an even level, which is not possible. Now, by ordinance, they're saying that, you know, industry has been unhappy because they're saying, you know, you need a social impact assessment. We don't want to have a social impact assessment. You need to have rehabilitation. This kind of rehabilitation is more than we can afford. So now, little by little, they're trying to chip away at what
and
that
erode the protections.
So the first thing that they've done is to say, social impact assessment, forget about it. You know, we don't want to have that. And the second is to say, we'll dilute the idea of consent. So while all the rest of the world is talking about free, prior, informed consent, here you have the government saying that, you know, we don't have
command.
Patience with consent. We will tell you what we want and we will take it. So it's, you know, and that they want to do through the ordinance route, which basically means that there is a denial of the rule of law even in the making of that law.
And just to explain to our listeners, what happens is that in India, the ruling party does not have majority in the upper house of parliament. And if it were to introduce this legislation there, it would fail. So it is passing it through a decree, an ordinance signed by the president, which makes it effectively the law. And it becomes very hard to overturn that. It can be, but it's exactly the kind of struggle that people like Usha will be involved with. One final question in this regard.
Just to clarify that the ordinance will lapse when the next session of parliament comes in. So they need to have something done by then. And they're trying to short circuit that too by saying that we will have a joint session of parliament.
Correct.
So that we will have a simple
Because in the joint session, the ruling party will have the majority. So that's the game being played here. In that context, given that in 2011, the UN Human Rights Council adopted the Protect, Respect Remedy for Business and Human Rights, where the state had an obligation to protect, corporations had a responsibility to respect, and in the gap, you needed a remedy. In that context, what do you expect companies operating in countries like India to do if they're sincere about respecting rights with regard to preventing a Bhopal or with regard to using land properly? I'm not using the word acquiring, but using land properly. What would be the two or three bits of advice you would give them?
See, the first thing is that this nexus that is developing between the corporation and the state, corporations themselves need to recognize that this is, you know, there is a disrespect for the law, there is a disrespect for the constitution, and there's a disrespect for the people. We've been asking in the context of the land acquisition, for instance, why did the state feel that it needed to change the law? Because they wanted to reduce conflict, because conflict increases enormously the costs of that transaction. So if you want people to go along with you, then you need to change the way in which you work. So hiding behind the state and trying to do something, you know, in which you cannot do directly is not going to be a solution to the problem. And I think people, the corporations need to recognize that. The second thing is that this, you know, there was one judgment in the Bhopal context, for instance, where a single judge of the Madras High Court had said that if any corporation wants to come and function in India, then it has to function within the terms of the Indian constitution. So you can't say, for instance, that 50 yards from my door, you can't have any protest. Protest is permitted in this country. So learning to respect rights.
Yes.
That is something that corporations are constantly trying, whether it's through slap suits or it's through, you know, using various techniques. They're trying to shrink rights. And that's a bad route to go. The third is, I think it is important to, you know, it is important not to victimize victims and ask victims to bear the cost of these these kinds of events. But more importantly, we really need to focus on not creating victims. And we don't see any disincentives in that emerging.
Right.
We need to provide those disincentives. Honestly, I think in the international arena, all the efforts at creating some kind of strong regime which will tell corporations how they can function well and yet not, you know, not discard people's rights, corporations don't seem to be very happy to have them come in, these principles. And we've seen every time we move forward a step, it's like pushing us back two steps. And I don't see that as solving any problems. It just, you know, it's like you created gated communities of corporations where you've got to keep the people out. This kind of thing, I don't see it lasting.
Thank you very much, Usha, and all the best with your work, and a very happy new year to you.
To you too. Thanks, Aleel.
Thank you.